It's November 29th, 2011. I am Pat Kelly, a member of the Endicott Society Oral History Committee, and I'm going to be talking with Professor Renata Mai Dalton, who retired in
December
of 2010 as a professor in the School of Business at the University of Kansas. And since it's your life, may we start in the beginning. Where were you born and your family and when and all that sort of thing, the groundwork.
You want to know when, huh?
Well, that you don't have. It's not required. But we can guess kind of, you know.
Yes, can't
you? We can get in the ballpark.
Anyway, I was born in Berlin, Germany in 1941 during the Second World War. And my parents were Walter Mai, M-A-I, and Elfriede Mai, and her maiden name is Cumin, C-U-M-I-N. My grandparents on my mother's side, my grandfather came from Italy in 1900. He was born in 1968. And my grandmother came from Silesia earlier.
1868?
I'm sorry. And she was born 1868. And they met in Berlin, and my grandfather had come to Germany because he was a stonemason, and the emperor, William II, I assume, wanted to have stonemasons to restore a lot of the castles and, you know, that had damage, taken on damage. And so that's why he was in Germany.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah. And what about my father's family came from Saxony. They were from what's called Chemnitz. It's C-H-E-M-N-I-T-Z. It was a fairly large city in Saxony. That's that.
You have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, that's very complicated. I have three half-brothers. I have one half-brother, Peter, who was born before me when my mother was in her first marriage. And then she married again, and there was a second one. And then, unfortunately, my father got a divorce and married again, and there are two brothers, Michael and Norbert. And two of them are deceased, and Michael is still in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Yeah.
And where were you? Your father was a stonemason, then, you said.
My grandfather.
Your grandfather. What did your father do?
Yeah. Well, my father, I think, officially went through an apprenticeship where he learned about, repairing watches and things, which was not at all what he wanted. He really wanted to be a businessman. And so that's what he did. He had his own business, his wholesale fruit and vegetable business. And during the war, he was driving these very... He's an excellent driver. He was driving these very dangerous trucks of ammunition through the villages through Germany to France, Belgium, where they had to evacuate the villages when his trucks would come through. So, but what that meant really was that he could get out during the war, and when he would come back, he'd bring me the most wonderful clothing and, you know, and boots and things that nobody else unfortunately had, and the whole neighborhood was waiting for me to outgrow them so that they could get them. And my mother was a bookkeeper. She was excellent in office work, which meant that all of our paperwork was well organized.
I see. Do you have other relatives, the aunts and uncles and cousins and things?
Well, my grandparents on my mother's side only had two children, my aunt, Helen with an E at the end, and she was married, of course, also was in Berlin, and she's the one I showed you in the picture, mm-hmm. had an apprenticeship in shoe sales, which meant all her life she knew all about shoes. You know, when you'd serve an apprenticeship in Germany, you really learn during that apprenticeship. Like my father knew all about watches, and my aunt knew all about shoes. But anyway, she passed away in the 80s. My mother passed away in 73. My father passed away when I was 20 years old, 61. So I've lost my parents very early, but they were wonderful parents.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So do you, but some of these, you still go back and have connections?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I go back to Germany very frequently. Mm-hmm. My brother Peter had two daughters, my nieces, and I have contact with them. Mm-hmm. And my brother Norbert has a very small little boy, and unfortunately Norbert passed away this year. And so as a little boy, you know, 5 years left, and of course I'm visiting there.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are different forms of German, correct? The language?
Yes.
Which one...
Do I speak?
Which one do you speak?
Well, a good thing is the Berliners can speak what you might call High German. In addition to what most people in German various areas have, a dialect, which is the Berliner dialect. So if I were to Berliner with you, you wouldn't understand me. If I speak my regular German, then we would be fine.
If I could speak German. Anyway, yeah. So did you were grade school? And the German school system and progression is very different. I mean, the European, I think, maybe,
yeah.
Not just German.
Right.
And where you don't just go from junior high to high school to whatever. You you have to start out at some point very early declaring which path you want to,
yeah,
take, and you have to pass certain levels and things. Is that correct?
Yeah, but it has changed over the years. And given that I was born in 41, my system is not currently the system.
Oh, I see.
But my system, and living in Berlin, it depended. Berlin, you had to decide after sixth grade. In other states within Germany, you had to decide after the fourth grade. To begin with, obviously when I was born during the war, I started school in first grade right afterwards, which meant Berlin was bombed out about 90%. Very few buildings were available, so we went to school in shifts. One group would go in the morning and the other group would go in the afternoon, you know, to use up the building space properly. What was fascinating to me, though, which is different from the States here, is PE was important for everybody. Even though we had no space, we would be in the basement on these mats and we would be having Sport, you know, okay, PE, regularly. And I still remember I was having very unconventional little shoes, you know, like rubber sole flat, and I would have holes in my socks sometimes. But anyway, so first grade, I started, I had to decide after sixth grade, or my family did. And because I grew up during the war, I was what you would consider a probably sensitive and nervous child, because as a baby, my mother had to, and my brother, we had to get out of bed many, many times overnight and run down into the bunkers. And so these years, you know, first years, mm-hmm, were very upheaval-like. And so I was usually pale and I was maybe anemic and so on. So the Germans, even then, had an excellent health system, which meant you could apply, or the doctor could recommend that you would go for a health resort stay. Mm-hmm. So I went for a six-week stay, and which meant that I did not have the first 6 weeks of English when I was going into the next grade, which then meant when the decision came to which school I would go to, you know, like the regular nine grades, the next one, which we would call Realschule or technical branch, which normally would having 10 grades or to the gymnasium, which would have 12 or 13, depending on whether you were in the west or in the east of Germany. I mean, it's all complicated. The teachers felt that I should go to the Realschule, which is the middle road. And besides, my father was in business, you know, long time ago, and that was the area where, if you wanted to go into business, that's where you'd go. Well, I started seventh grade in the Realschule, or what we called Zweite Technische Oberschule, Second Technical High School. And it was good for me because it was a fresh start. You know, I'd gone through a difficult time. My parents just hadn't gotten a divorce and so on. So a fresh start, I think, is good for most children. And I was, well, I was always good in school, but I was excellent there. And I still remember twice a teacher would come from a different classroom and would ask if she could have my homework to show the other children in the class.
Wow.
Very odd, you know. But anyway, and then they recommended that I would be transferred over to the gymnasium. And my English, by the way, I want to mention, my grade, the grades in German and English were divided by, what do you say, verbal skills and written skills. My written skills were an F, and my verbal skills were barely a D. Anyway, my mother said, we really can't afford my going into the gymnasium, and, you know, I should stay at school.
And you had to pay for that, but not the other?
No, you don't pay for any. No, don't pay for any. But the point is, if you are going to the school that I was in, you'd be done in 10th grade and would earn money after that.
Oh, right.
If you were to go to the gymnasium, it would be 2 or 3 years longer. But also, if you were to go to the university, then it would be longer still.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's what we did. And then I finished in 10th grade, and I started an apprenticeship in business. The first one, and that's probably, well, it's not a good episode. I stayed only 3 months because one of the top people in this plastic-making company molested me. And that wasn't a place to stay. And at the time, of course, you just left. And I ended up just doing hourly work initially in the fashion industry, which was wonderful. After, I don't know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, they offered me an apprenticeship. And so that's when I started apprenticeship. It was normally for, it's called Industriekaufmann, which is industrial merchandising. And you'd go, by the way, at that time you worked 5.5 days. So you'd work Monday through Friday and half a day on Saturday. And you would go to school 2 full days for the apprenticeship work. And after school, you'd go back to work. Mm-hmm. So you'd be in school from maybe 8 to 2. And by 2:30, you'd be at your work. And then you work till 5 or 6, depending. It's just amazing. And the fashion industry, by the way, was fascinating to me because we weren't sewing the fashions. You know, we were giving out that work to subcontractors. But where I was, they did the designing and the selecting of the fabric and the buttons and the, you know, style. And then two times a year would be the big fashion show. And then 2 more times would be like the smaller shows that would be for after orders. So in other words, when you had the big fashion show and you see the models, and I mean, I was, what was I, 17? You know, I'd be helping the models get dressed behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed how ugly they looked when they came in the morning when they were ready to go out, you know. They were glamorous. Anyway, and those shows were very late in the evening, you know. The good thing about it was that all of us who were working behind the scenes could eat the leftovers that all these guests had gotten during the day, you know, the special buffets. I mean, really outstanding things. Anyway, so that was the fashion industry. And I did well in school again, and so they let me take the exam after 2.5 instead of 3 years. And then the boss of the company, this was a woman, very rare at the time, she had a boyfriend, and he was starting a business in Berlin for Martini and Rossi, the Italian and French vermouth company. And he needed somebody who would run his office. So here I was, you know. I don't know when I finished apprenticeship. It must have been 19, something like that. And she asked me if I would, you know, work with him or for him. And that's what I did. And I ended up at, after a move, in an office right off the Kurfürstendamm in Berlin, which is one of the main, you know, cities. And, 15 minutes already. And what was interesting is I was, of course, I was the only woman, and all the salespeople, the agents, you know, would go out to all the restaurants were men. So I essentially was telling 7 men, all older than I was, what to do. And I had the backing of my boss, very strong backing, which because he didn't know any of the business stuff, you know. But he was an excellent person. He used to be an antique dealer and knew a lot of things and knew all then about liquor, had been a Berlin agent for Nestle, you know, Nescafe. Mm-hmm. Big deal in Germany at the time. And over the world, really. But anyway, so I was there, and one day in the evening, I had tickets for the opera, and in Germany, in Berlin particularly, in the cities, the houses would be locked at 8 o'clock in the evening. Most people had keys for the doors to the apartment buildings. I lived in an apartment building. So what happens is at about 7 o'clock or 7:30, everybody needs to get home if they don't have a key for a given apartment, or they needed to go to all the cultural events. So I left my office. I ran just 100 meters to the taxi stand, you know, where the cab stand is. And people line up. They ask each other where they are going. And then they take a cab, like 2 or 3 together, if they're going in the same direction, because there are not enough cabs at that time of the day. Mm-hmm. So that's how I met my husband. So what happened is he and I and someone else went in with the same cab. He wasn't going to the opera. I don't know where he's going. But anyway, at the same time, I was taking business English at a at an evening school. And since he was American, I thought there's a great opportunity to speak English. So when he asked me if he could give me a call and we could, I said yes. Well, anyway, so that's how I met my husband.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, he happened to have been in the Air Force, which I didn't know at the time. He was in civilian clothing. And eventually, when we got married, that's how I got to the States.
I see. Well, we were going to come to that if we hadn't. Well, wonderful.
I'm looking at the time. I think we have to hurry it up.
No, we don't. We have 2 hours. Anyway, oftentimes people have had someone in their early background, before we move on too far,
yeah.
Who a teacher or a relative or someone who was very influential in their life. And I don't know that I have done an oral history of myself.
So you haven't thought about it?
I hadn't thought about it until now, and I was thinking, if there were someone.
Yeah. Well, there are probably several people when you think about it, you know, over your lifetime. But early on, it was definitely my mother and my father. I mean, no doubt about it. My father was a businessman. He had a certain style. He was efficient. He was quick. He was direct. He was, lots of things. And it seems, in terms of temperament, I've taken after him. So has my brother Michael, who's still in Berlin. You know, it's a certain tempo or so that you're born with. And my mother was a wonderful person. She loved children, and she gave us a lot of freedom. And she, at the same time, was an independent person because she was, what do you say, particularly as a woman at that time, when she was, I was telling you, she had married before, mm-hmm. and my older brother Peter came out of that marriage. But she would not take any junk from anybody, even though she was friendly, She was not the way my father was. I mean, she was not aggressive and so on. But she would just not take any junk. And she was saying the reason she got a divorce is that Peter's father raised his hand to her, and she decided before he would hit her, she was going to leave.
Good for her.
Right.
Right.
Can you imagine? And
more women.
Would figure that out. Well, I don't know. I think you have to have a strong self-confidence, mm-hmm. because, I mean, you be by yourself with a child, you know, in, 1938, 39? I mean, incredible. But anyways, but she was just a very kind person. She always helped other people. I remember, you know, we'd have, when Germany, of course, was occupied, East and West, there'd be people coming from the East and would be in, what would you call it, where people were housed when they, left their homeland,
Hostels or something like that?
Well, it's only for people who are coming normally from other countries. You'll have it here. Flüchtlinge, I don't know what the American word is, English word is. But anyway, so she would, for instance, even though this woman was an alcoholic, but she was trying and she was knitting a lot. And so my mother would give her an order for, you know, a jacket for me or something, just to keep people, enable them to get some money, have some friendship, do some, you know, these things left an impression on me. But my mother didn't do it at her own, what would you say, happiness or expense. I mean, you know, some people go out and don't think about themselves enough and just help all the time and run around. My mother wasn't like that. She's just a very kind woman who was realistic, you know, nonsensible, nonsensical.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now then, during this your period in the fashion industry, this was after the war.
Yes.
And such.
This was in, I think, 61 or something like that. Mm-hmm. 59, I graduated, I think, with my apprenticeship. Yeah, all of that was fine, except that when I was working in the office at Martini and Rossi, I also went to another night school. I kept on going to school. I just loved school and learning. And I learned a lot of things. I was in school for what's called executive secretary training, which is very different than a secretary here. As a matter of fact, you couldn't take the exam before you were at least 21 and had an apprenticeship. And the exam was, I mean, typing and shorthand were, what do you say, you had to have a certain
level
before you could even go to the school. But anyway, it told you about political issues, the social graces, about making out itineraries, all of this stuff. Well, as a result, of course, I knew a lot about office stuff in addition, so I implemented a new bookkeeping system at this office. And little did I know, you know, this is what happened in life in a male-dominated area. One of the guys from the main, from headquarters of Martini, implemented the same system in two other offices in other cities in Berlin, which in itself was fine. It would have been better if they had sent me to teach them, but that's okay. But then I said to them, well, I'd like to have more money. You know, I mean, after all.
Look what I've done.
Yeah, yeah. And they said, well, that's unfortunate, but we can't do that because that would be unfair to the others who are having the same positions in the other cities. I said, what? Are you nuts? So I was going to leave. My boss said, well, if I give you privately more money every month, would you stay? No. So I went interviewed for a secretary position in the German Institute for Economic Research, which was nice, very nice, a completely different, you know, world, of course. I was working for a professor whose research area was German industry and Russia, at the time the Soviet Union. That meant I learned a lot of other terminology, a lot of other issues, but and I was working with another secretary since he had two departments, you know. and it was very nice. But it didn't take long, and I said to him, you know, I'd really like to do something else. He said, well, what would you want to do? Would you like to be a statistician? You know, this is like the next level, but you need a university education for that, which I didn't have, of course.
Well, I was going to ask you about that.
No, didn't happen. But at the same time, then I met my husband, and then I went to the U.S., and that was not relevant anymore. Mm-hmm. After I'd been in the U.S., I think I went to, in 65, my husband was stationed in Michigan.
And his name?
Walter Dalton, Dalton. That's why my name now is My Dalton. My is my maiden name.
I see.
Dalton.
I
wanted to keep my father's name because I didn't know, you know, my other brother doesn't have children. Michael and Norbert is gone now. But anyway, he was first stationed in Michigan, and where do I go from there? Our daughter Selena was born in Selfridge Air Force Base.
Oh, she was a lovely woman.
Yeah,
lovely young girl. Remember her.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She's very nice, still is. And I had brought with me, or we had brought with us, a son, child of Walter's. And I adopted Mike. It's a side. I don't discuss that with people normally. It's my two children, period.
Mm, right.
But anyway, after 2 years, well, first we were transferred. When you're in the military, you know, you move around a lot. We moved around 8 times in 12 years. By the way, you want to go back to Berlin before we go onto the military?
Yes, okay.
Yeah, you have anything else in there? I mean, obviously, I was at the German Institute for Economic Research and then got married. And then, by the way, the getting married was not that easy. My ex-husband was African-American at the time, of course. Neither the military wanted mixed marriages. My mother wasn't sure. She was not at all prejudiced, but she thought it would be a very difficult life. And that was, of course, true. But there was this little boy. I definitely wanted to make sure, you know, he had a future. And I investigated. I wrote to the U.S. government, and I said, I'd like to come to the States for 3 months and just see what it is like. I'm considering getting married. And they said, no. I said, how stupid can you be if you don't want me to be married? You know, let me see it, then I figure it out. But anyway, we did get married, and we went to the U.S., but then we were transferred after Selena was born, 6 months old, to Oregon. And then after, we were on a radar site, way out in nowhere, but we made wonderful friends. And then Walter was sent to Vietnam. And the reason I'm coming back to it is during that time, the children and I went back to Berlin. And I continued to work at the German Institute for Economic Research.
And you had done so many other night schools or whatever, all these things. Well, while you didn't officially have a degree, you had the expertise that would be learned.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of Germans have good educations. A lot of Germans know a lot of stuff. Maybe I was a little bit faster than average, but I mean, there are a lot of competent people in Germany, at least at the time. Mm-hmm. But it had nothing to do. I mean, no matter what I did, it was not university qualified. And when Walter came back, well, during the time in Berlin, while he was in Vietnam, and he was in Da Nang during the Tet Offensive, and things were scary. And we would exchange tapes, you know, back and forth. But anyway, when he was there, Mike went to the John F. Kennedy School, which is a bilingual school for children that are from diplomats and so on. So he was instructed in his first school year and first year and a half in German and English, which was great.
Oh.
While Selena was, you know, she came to Germany by that time, I think she was two, she had started speaking English, but then only spoke German. And when we would be trying to make these tapes for Walter, you know, I still remember one Mike said, "Selena doesn't want to speak English." But anyway, then we went back to the States. And let me see, we went to Klamath Falls, Oregon again. And I decided I needed something else and being at home with two children. I mean, all my life, I just couldn't do it.
Right.
I got depressed. I mean, that just doesn't work for me very well. So I said, well, what am I going to do? How do I start school? And I saw an announcement in the local paper, and it said enrollment for the Oregon Technical Institute was at the gym a certain day, certain time. And I said, okay, why don't I show up? I'm going to enroll in something. And, you know, I had no idea about universities, nothing. I mean, Walter didn't go to college, and nobody else in the States. I knew nothing, you know. At home, I didn't have anyone close who had studied, because you can get your education in Germany with apprenticeships, the same things that you would be doing with a university degree here, you know. And anyway, I showed up at the gym, and there were all these long lines at the tables, and people were having those cards. Remember those computer cards? With those whatever?
Punch cards.
Yes, the punch cards. They were having a box for each of the classes, and the faculty member would be sitting there, or an assistant. And, you know, once they were all given out, the class was full, and that was the end of that. But you started out someplace else, and they said, well, where do you have your physical? I said, I'm sorry, I didn't know I needed one. And they said, oh, you can get it later. And where do you have your SAT score? I have no idea what that is. And, oh, you can, well, you come to such and such an office, you take it, that's fine. Anyway, I ended up with four classes, a full load, that morning, and started going to school. I made sure I only was in school, what was it, twice a week, because I needed a babysitter for Selena, and Selena was not open to having a babysitter of any kind. I mean, she broke my heart. I would take her to this lady. We were in the military housing, you know. Mm-hmm. Take her to the lady. She'd be sitting stock still on a chair, not say a word, not cry, and stayed there. She was... very. I mean, it broke my heart. It was horrible. But I said, I'm sorry, child. You have to learn.
You have to adjust.
This can't be normal. Anyway, so that's where I started college. And then eventually I took classes. You know, you can take these, classes where people come to communities and teach. Mm-hmm. Like University of Oregon had branches where you could take classes, and Southern Oregon State College, it's now Southern Oregon University, had classes. And talk about influential people. There was one lady, Barbara Rosentrater, who was teaching English 2, English literature. I think it was English 2. And that was one woman that was most influential. We read the, what's her name? Albert Camus. And we read a literature that essentially was an example of how you are responsible for yourself, not that I hadn't been, you know, and that you have choices, and that you, whatever choice you make, you live with, and at the same time, your choices couldn't be hurtful to others. You know, that's mm-hmm. where your freedom ended, mm-hmm. existentialist readings. So she had an enormous influence just on, because she was excellent in what she taught. It wasn't just reading, you know, mm-hmm. discussions and so on. And what is, a sign of the times, she was the wife of the chair in the history department at Southern Oregon State College. And so she was just having a minor role in the English department, teaching alongside, you know, whatever, like part-time and whatever. But here she is. You know, she mm-hmm. should have been the chair of the English
yeah.
department.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I got accumulated a number of courses, and then it was time to decide how to finish, you know. And Walter, in the meantime, let me see, was being transferred to Point Arena in California, which is another radar site way out by the ocean, but very small military site, not any place where people have towns, so where you live. So it was easy to go to Ashland, where the main campus of Southern Oregon State College was, to go full-time, and I just needed another year and a half by then to finish the undergraduate degree. Because I challenged some classes and, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't all that hard. I would challenge German literature and I would be analyzing, you know, Brecht or something like that. I mean, it was interesting. Anyway, so then I got my undergraduate degree. You want any more about that part?
Sure.
Well, I mean, you have any? I did well, of course. I had a 4.0 and I was a top graduate.
I never doubted that.
I don't think that was really fair because I was only there for a year and a half. But I'd had all A's before, you know.
Right.
And so, but, you know, it was so interesting. It was really interesting when I started at Oregon Technical Institute and I had to do the tests and all the stuff afterwards. Mm-hmm. They'd call me in and they'd say, well, I think, and then I had an IQ test that was part of this whole thing. And it was sort of average. And the IQ would ask stuff. I had no idea what was asking. You know, like what day does Thanksgiving fall on every time? And when is the something equinox? And I had no idea. So, but that tells you something. And I've learned this for my later life. These tests mean nothing, right, depending on your cultural background. When I came to KU, and I'm working with all these students that are disadvantaged, who are coming from different backgrounds, have to have, quotation marks, certain scores, or their scores might be an 18 one day and a 24 the other day. It tells you it makes no sense.
Right.
So to put important decisions on these issues, you know, to me, never made any sense, didn't ever count for me. And then I came this other, I don't know what test it was, but the guy was saying, well, and he hummed and hawed, he said, there is some evidence of dishonesty. I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, it was because they would be asking similar questions with different wording. You know, and when English is your second language and you haven't been in the country that long, it's real easy that you don't answer it consistently,
right,
particularly if the questions deal with the culture where you are unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But so, you know, here I was a liar and I wasn't particularly bright.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, then I went to Southern Oregon. Then I decided I had to get a PhD because the undergraduate really was just a preliminary for what I really wanted to do, because I felt with my education in Germany, I'd had that much, you know, mm-hmm. even though I did learn things mm-hmm. and I enjoyed college. By the way, I took PE regularly.
Oh.
I'd take tennis, I'd take gymnastics, mm-hmm. just like German times.
Right. Well, you grow up with that. That's in your blood.
Yeah,
I guess,
it,
right?
it still yeah. is. Yeah.
When you, by that time, did you want to teach?
No. No, I didn't know really what I wanted. I just knew I was going to get a PhD. Mm-hmm.
I see.
Again,
you
I
won
didn't.
That.
Well,
right.
Teaching would have been okay because, I mean, that's what I saw in college when I was taking classes, you know. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, my father had been in business. My mother was business-oriented.
And you yourself had done very well in
business
already.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, the options were open, but the issue was something very different. Again, never occurred to me. I said to my faculty members there at Southern Oregon, I said, well, you know, where do you think I should go and get a PhD? And he said, well, have you checked with anyone yet? I said, no. He said, well, it's not that easy to get in. I said, well, I have a 4.0. It shouldn't be too hard. No. That they didn't think that was right. That just blew me off. I mean, I said, what is this? Well, anyway, I didn't have too many choices because by then Walter was reassigned again. And he tried to stay in the Pacific Northwest. So he was assigned to Blaine, so came from the radar site, to a place, Blaine, which is the last town north of the U.S. at the Canadian border.
Oh.
And we were living in a military housing about 10 miles south of there, not far from Bellingham. And Bellingham has Western Washington State College. Oh. But actually before that, what happened is when I graduated that last week, and I knew I was going to go to Berlin with the children for the summer before we would move. You know, we packed up everything, put it in storage. The military did that. I can't believe I did all this stuff, I tell you. I had very good friends who had gone to college with me there, and they were good babysitters of Mike and Selena after school when I happened to be in class or something. But I left them with these friends and got into my car, decided I was going to drive to the University of Washington. Now, we're talking about Oregon, 13 miles north of the California corner, and we are talking about Washington, 4 hours from Portland, north in Washington State. But I decided that's what I was going to do. That's what I did. I went up there, and I wanted to be actually in clinical psychology because my undergraduate degree was in clinical psychology. I'd served whatever you call that service, you know, for a semester at a mental health place.
Internship?
Internship, yeah, right. But, you know, while you go to school, it's mm-hmm. like you get mm-hmm. credit. So. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up there. I don't know when it was. I must have left at 6 in the morning, and I think I got there by 3 or something like that. And talked to someone in clinical psychology, and they said, well, have you taken the Miller's analogy test? No. And they said, well, we have 800 applicants for 10 graduate student entry positions. I said, what? And, of course, later on I took the Miller analogy test to go jump ahead and did very poorly. I mean, it was just, again, below average without any doubt. I mean, not competitive with 800 applicants. But so when he told me that, I mean, at that time he hadn't admitted me or not. But I said, okay, I better keep on going since Walter is stationed up north. So I went another 2 hours to Bellingham. I got there like 5:30, 6 o'clock. One of the faculty members was still there. When he saw my 4.0, he was desperate to get me. But they didn't have a PhD program. They only had a master's program. And so I said most likely I would come. And then I went home. Back home, did my applications. But anyway, that summer I drove home, I flew home, and found out when I arrived my mother had died. So it was a hard time. And at the end of, I think I stayed there for 4 weeks with the children, and we went back to Washington. I started school there, but I didn't give up on the University of Washington. And I found out in the meantime that there was a professor, Fred Fiedler, F-I-E-D-L-E-R. His area was leadership, which was interesting to me from a business side. But also, he has done a lot of research, had lots of grants with the military. So I said, oh, this might be interesting to him that I have been with my husband in the military for 14 years. And so why don't I write to his office? His area was social psychology and leadership and, excuse me, part business. And so I wrote to him, and he wrote, or his assistant wrote back, that he is interested in admitting me, but I'd have to come this year. And because I had said, well, I'll come the next fall. And he said, no, because then the whole application period will start over and I'll be competing with all these other people that would be, not that he said I wouldn't get in, but anyway, he wanted me to come. So what that meant was I took a room in Seattle. I would drive down every Monday, 6 in the morning from Bellingham. I would take my classes through Thursday, would leave for home. In the meantime, another good friend who originally was from Berlin and her family lived at the same housing area. And so she took care of the children in the morning, and of course Walter was there after school. But anyway, then I would do the washing and the cooking and studying and, you know, whatever one does in 4 days or 3 days. And I started the same thing over again. And anyway, then I went back home, stayed at home in the summer. He wanted me to continue to go to school, which is most graduate students did. I said it wasn't going to work. Anyway, eventually I moved to Seattle. We bought a house there. I did my studies there. I got a divorce in the meantime. We had, you know, changed a lot. Although we're good friends, we, you know, still no issue, no problem.
That.
Yeah. And so that's how it happened. And I had a good time in Seattle, and it was really good that I was aligned with Professor Fiedler, because he is famous in leadership. He has come up with one of the seminal leadership theories at the time. So any textbook you go into, you'll see Fred Fiedler. And, of course, that was good for me, particularly once I was on the job market.
Right.
And, of course, University of Washington was a good place.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about to finish with this one. We have about 13 minutes left. But I was wondering, are there, before we move on to coming to KU and moving on in your life, were there any periods during the war and living in Berlin that were particularly
Well, there was some time, I don't know if it was about a year, but Hitler wanted all mothers and children to be evacuated out of the city because it became clear it was, I mean, super dangerous. And so my mother and my brother, Peter and I, we were evacuated to Saxony. I remember, I mean, I was little. I was maybe a year, 2 years old. And I remember my father coming to visit us there. But when the war was over, we had to walk back home. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 300 kilometers.
Which is how many miles?
Well, divided by 1.6, which is about 200 maybe. Mm-hmm. 200. Yeah. But anyway, it was dangerous.
Were you alone, just your family?
No, it was dangerous because the Russians were coming from the east, and most people who particularly used to be in the west, I mean the western part of Germany, or in Berlin, of course, wanted to go back to their homes, but also didn't want to be caught with the Russians. One thing is really interesting, Pat, that I just heard about 2 weeks ago for the first time. You know, you hear about war atrocities. My mother would always tell me that when they were coming back, the women were being raped by the Russians. And I never heard about it. You know, you all these years. And it's hard to talk about because, you know, it's my mother.
Right, of course.
But you hear about it in Africa now, you hear about it in other countries, and somehow the history has forgotten that.
Mm-hmm. Glossed over it.
Yeah, yeah, and at the same time, you know, the women all lived, what should you say, relatively normal life, despite these things, you know. But anyway, when we would walk back to Berlin, because of that, we had to be in treks, you know, in groups of people. Mm-hmm. And we'd be staying in barns overnight and so on. And I still remember all we had was a little, little wooden cart with our belongings, you know. And I was so little, I could sit on top, didn't have to walk with all of them all the time. And then we walked into Berlin. I mean, it's hard to believe.
Oh, it's
isn't
yeah,
it?
Right. And then did you have a place to live in Berlin?
Well, we were so fortunate. On our street, many houses were bombed out. Ours were still there. So we could go back, essentially, to the same apartment where we were.
I see.
Yeah. And that's how my father, our father, you know, started the business, essentially. The front part, I don't know how much you know about apartment buildings, but front part in Berlin many times has a business like a storefront, mm-hmm. where we moved into the front of that building. And when I was six or so, which was maybe 2 years after the war, that's where he did this his retail business, but his main business was wholesale, which is a huge market, you know, about a kilometer away from where we lived. But no, we were very fortunate, and my grandparents lived in the back of that complex. And my godmother's parents lived, you know, one story up. So, I mean, we were fortunate with that. But, of course, we were playing in the ruins, literally. It was dangerous. I learned swimming in the canal where the big ships would be coming, you know, the barges. And I still remember we tried to catch on to them. We would be full of tar. I mean, it's amazing. And my brother, when I learned how to swim, my brother, who was 4 years older, would give me an inner tube, a bicycle inner tube, put it around me twice. And he and the friends were doing whatever, and here I was, padding along. I mean, when you think about it, you know? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was the Berlin part.
I see.
But it got better, of course, and we moved, and all these other things happened there.
Was the feeling with... Were you affected much by the Jewish...
Well, I didn't know anything about it for the longest time. My mother was telling me... That, yes, you know, later, much later, when I would ask, I said, well, you know, what happened? And she said, well, we knew that we had some friends that were, what do you say, taken away from their homes, but we were told they would be relocated. You know, it reminds mm-hmm. me of a Japanese during the war or something, although, right. I mean, that was horrible as well. But my mother had no idea about what was really happening, and my father had no idea what was really happening. But I think she knew that it wasn't good, you know, because the atmosphere that she was in when I wasn't born yet, and then, of course, during the war, I was too little. But the atmosphere in Berlin must have been poisonous. But on the other hand, Berlin has always been a vibrant city. For instance, Berlin, you know, lots of homosexuals were living freely, lots of artists, lots of, I mean, the fashion industry where I was, you know, there were a good number of good friends that happened to be Jewish, and they were, you know, Berlin has been very tolerant. So I think by the time Hitler came around, nobody believed that it would get the way it got. And by the time they had a feeling that it was really getting bad, they couldn't speak up anymore without risking their own families. I mean, it's just horrible when you think about it. But on the other hand, think about what's happened in the United States.
Right.
I mean, here I come with an African-American husband, and the same junk all over, as bad. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, you know, what is the matter with people? It's horrible. It's just horrible.
And it is people. It isn't German people or...
No, it can happen everywhere. Right. That's just right. A tragedy. That's the reason... You have to think about it and act accordingly every single day. You know, all right. These groups here and in Germany now, the neo-Nazi groups and so on, you have to keep that in check as quickly as possible. And at the same time, you talk about freedom, freedom of speech and all these things. Unless everybody is vigilant, you cannot maintain it. Somebody is going to win out, particularly when the economy is bad, and which was the case in Germany.
Right, right.
You know, Germany, I think one of the reasons we had the Second World War and Hitler could rise were the reparation costs that were imposed on the Germans after the First World War.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
They were so severe that nobody could make a good living. And so when somebody came who was going to be their Führer, you know, it was much easier for people to follow him.
I see.
Oh. Horrible.
Of course, I think of Berlin and with American movies, and things, and you know, and the swastika, and the marching,
oh
you
God,
know, the,
yes.
The goose stepping, and the hordes, of, and then just being in Berlin many years later, and where the wall had been, and you know, and all of that, you don't get a clear picture of.
Well, unless you live there, you don't understand. But I mean, Berlin is a great city; has always been a great city, just wonderful. I mean, opportunities I had when I grew up. I mean, and the school system and the social system are so excellent, were excellent, with almost nothing in terms of resources. Like an example, I think we have to stop him.
Well, we have a few more minutes.
An example, which I many times think about here, when I've taken my students to cultural events and made it part of the scholarship, mentoring scholarship program of the Multicultural Scholars, we would get tickets in our school when we wanted them for a mark and 74 cents to go to operas, to theaters, to operetta, whatever you wanted. These were leftover tickets that the theaters would bring to the schools and say, you know, these are available. Can you go, or do you want to go during the next week or whatever? That's how I grew up. You didn't have to be rich to be able to do these things. Mm-hmm. And then the surrounding area in Berlin is beautiful. We have lots of lakes and rivers and forests. And my mother would take us regularly to these. She loved to walk. She had a heart condition, but she could walk. So we would have picnics in the forest every weekend, every other weekend. You'd take a bus, you'd be right there. Just gorgeous over there.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, we're about ready to end up with this. I guess it's not a tape. I don't know what it
digital
is.
Digital recording.
Anyway, we'll close this out, and then maybe be about ready to come to KU.
I guess so.
Right?
Can I have a bathroom break?
You're being recorded.
I don't care.
Okay, we're stop. Where does it say stop? Oh, here it is. After you got your PhD at University of Washington. And such, and you and Mike had separated.
Walter.
Right. Michael is the son.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it was time to decide what to do.
Yeah.
And I did have the options and considered all three. I considered business, government, or university. And you talk about someone who has been influential. I had a faculty member on my PhD committee. What's her name? And she said, the only woman, again, very few women in business, of course, at the time. She said, you can always go to government or business, but you cannot always switch over to university. So I would recommend that you start with universities. So while I was looking, I already had a part-time job with the government, the state of Washington. And I was working in the lab with military grants with Fred Fiedler. So I really had options and connections, but I took her advice seriously and I said, okay, I'll try. Well, the problem with interviewing at universities is you have to leave the house and travel to the universities who want you to come.
They don't
and
come
I had two
that.
Children. Yes. And so I had lined up interviews at the University of Washington, at Northwestern, at a variety of well-reputed universities. It also is expensive. Even though you get the expenses paid, you know they're always more expensive than you, like childcare or, you know, all these things. I decided if I wanted to be in academia, I cannot go all over the country and keep on interviewing. I had to decide. And in the meantime, John Tollefson, I'd been to the University of Washington, University of Kansas, and John Tollefson kept on calling me. And he was a wonderful person. And I interviewed with then-dean, goodness, what was his name? He left after 1 year and was CEO of...
Dillon's?
Dillon's, yes.
That started with a B.
No, I don't think a B.
No.
But I know, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway... I decided that's what I was going to do. I researched. I had no idea where Kansas was. I had to look. I mean, I knew sort of, but I didn't know the adjoining states or nothing. Checked things out. I felt it's awfully far south, given my family situation. So when I came and interviewed, I talked to people in the school system, and I talked to other people and to faculty, and I asked about racial issues in Lawrence, oh, no, no, we don't have any of those. Well, they had no idea what they were talking about. But anyway, I decided I would come. I remember when I put down the phone after I said to John, and I was in this beautiful house in Seattle. I mean, windows all over, sky, what do you call it?
Skylights.
Ravine, a little brook sound. I mean, it was a gorgeous setting. And so I wasn't sure I wanted to leave, but I had to make a decision. Anyway, I hung up and cried. I said, oh, God, I didn't. But I said, well, you know, it's realistically, this is a good school. Maybe it's okay for the kids. Anyway, so we decided to come and packed up everything. And Mike was a senior, was a junior in high school. He said, Mom, if I go with you, can I come back to the University of Washington to study? I said, yes, you can. I understand. And, you know, it's very nice of you that you have a good attitude and so on. Selena was a seventh grader, so we moved. She started eighth grade at West Junior High. Within 1 week, we had three examples of racism. One kid called her a burned potato. Another one told her not to listen to KPRS. That's the Colored People radio station, it was called. Another one told her not to play with a friend who was in school with her, who was African American. And I said, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? Mike went to high school, was a senior, of course. Mike has always been an excellent runner. And so he went onto the cross-country team, and he was telling me, well, he was a good student, and he was in a chemistry class. And I went to see the teacher, who also happened to have been the coach of the cross-country team, who proceeded to tell me that my son was different than the other kids, meaning the other black kids, which I was, God, not again. Selena moved over to the high school. There were classes from, diversity literature, I would call it today, you know, where they read about authors that are non-white.
Oh.
And I don't know what the term was, but she wanted to enroll in one of those classes where she would have this literature, and I said, oh, well, what I have experienced, I don't know if I wanted to go in there. Why don't you go and talk to the teacher? Talk to the teacher and said, you know, she's white. Mm-hmm. She said, what approach do you take? And what? No problems whatsoever in the school system here, and I knew right away she couldn't take that class. We were really fortunate because we had some friends at KU who... Vernell Spearman. Mm-hmm. Vernell was on campus and was really looking after issues that dealt with diversity on campus. And as part of her work, she would invite speakers and so on. And she invited Margaret Walker. Had Margaret Walker after the presentation at the house and invited Selena to come. And, I mean, it was really good for Selena. Mike got out of here within a year. But for Selena, it was really good to have some African-American friends who had achieved things. One of the issues was for Selena always. Selena always stuck up for the underdog. And fairness was very important to her. Mike was much more settled back, laid back. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd take stuff. He would be bothered by it, but it wasn't. Selena, because she would speak up, was always a problem. You know, and so I was lucky, really, that we had a few people that were helping her. That, of course, she had me. I was a professor at KU, which, you know, indirectly gives you a little bit more pull. Mm-hmm. But we had a number of fights with the school system. I mean, I remember when one of the new superintendents came and the parents who were concerned about these issues met with him, he had never heard of diversity issues. Never heard. And I was outraged. And he later on accused us of being prejudiced against him because he didn't know these things. So in other words, you're prejudiced too because mm-hmm. I said, this can't be real. I mean, you know, yeah, I'm coming from Germany. I didn't grow up with this junk. I mean, fortunately, because I wasn't around when Hitler was around. But what I saw here, it was incredible. And this supposedly was a good state. And I think, relatively speaking, it was an excellent state, you know. But anyway, so we've had these issues. Other issues dealt with school. I mean, this none of this is KU yet. But those were very important issues that shaped what I could do here and what I was interested in. I remember that Selena was very good at playing the clarinet already in Seattle. So she took lessons from a clarinet professor here. I don't remember his name. Linda and...
Maxim,
yes. And so she was really good. And she got into the high school. And the rule was, if you wanted to be in symphonic band, you had to be in marching band. Now, marching band wasn't her thing. First of all, if you play classical music and you have to march with your instrument, you know, weather and shine, this is not a good thing. I mean, it doesn't help you playing any. And there were several others. And the problem was with marching band, you had to be there at 7:30 or whatever, which was the time when they also had debate class, Latin, and so on. So there were several parents and their children who were forced into marching band in order to feed the numbers that were needed, that, what's his name, Foster, needed to recruit to KU. Because
Bob
they had
Foster.
Bob Foster. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, this isn't right. You know, not another one of those justice things. Mm-hmm. And so I got together with a few parents. I invited a few, and maybe five or something. We were at our house. And then we wanted to meet with someone at the school. The school had heard that we had gotten ourselves together. And wouldn't you believe it, they invited all the members, the parents of the band members. So here we were in the cafeteria. I don't know how many, 100 or more, and us five. Mm-hmm. The parents of the band kids had no idea what the rules were because their kids weren't interested
right.
in being in symphonic band or in the orchestra or whatever, you know. But I said to myself, this is outrageous. But of course, we were right. And so they had to change the rules that the children that didn't want to be in marching band didn't have to. Then they made the rules that you couldn't be, what was it? You couldn't compete. This was the year before. You couldn't compete for any of the state music competitions if you weren't in symphonic band or the other band. Of course, they hadn't been in there, so they didn't want them to compete. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it took us, 2 years or something to move this thing around. And then in order to compete, you had to send in a tape to Wichita. That year it was in Wichita. And I think Selena was one of two clarinetists that were invited to go. Said to myself, what nonsense all of this is, you know. But anyway, that was my start and knowing about the school system. And it was tough. It was tough. And boy, I didn't need it, tell you.
I guess not.
Didn't need it. So I got to KU. KU, I had very nice colleagues. I got here in 79, August 79. And that was the year, I think, they hired 12 people. That was a lot of faculty to the School of Business. I think we were maybe in a year or two, we were like 64 faculty. Later on, we were only 54. So it tells you something. And there were several women that were hired. When I was hired, there was only Marilyn Taylor, I think, and one other person that were the only tenure-track women. And again, these petty issues that are important issues. For instance, the floor where the faculty members are, still, well, now it has been changed, but there was only one bathroom. It was for men.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Never mind that the secretarial pool was there and they were all women. Mm-hmm. Nobody who ever built this or ever arranged it felt secretaries had to use the bathroom, you know? Mm-hmm. So we were joking around, a few women of us. We said, well, you know, we have two options. One is to put an extra bathroom on the floor, on the top, or we change the bathroom. If the guys feel it's not important, why don't we change it? One year it's a men's one and one is a women. And I mean, this is so small stuff. And, you know, some of the guys would be standing in front of the bathroom when it was a woman's one and would be talking badly. I remember once, I don't know what it was, a sign was changed. But anyway, I mean, the first year I said, this is stupid. But it wasn't right, you know.
Right.
Anyway, it was changed eventually. I love teaching. I had a good time, even though, as with all faculty that get started, you know, teaching two-hour classes in a row, which is what I had asked for, really. But 4 hours of being on is exhausting, particularly when you teach certain classes the first time.
Yeah, I was wondering, did you have a certain area of business that you specialized in?
Yeah, usually. I mean, I came out of the leadership area. And the area was called officially organization behavior. So you have classes in there that are management. I also taught the human resources ones, organization change and development. I was interested in workforce diversity, so I built a class on that. So those, you know, it's you have several areas within the school. And mm-hmm. So when you're being hired, you go into whatever you're hired for. And what you qualified for. But yeah, it was a specific area. But I enjoyed my students. I always invested myself in the students. You know, I always felt everybody really should be able to do well if they want to. And I was never one of those that was piddly about stuff. You know, I tried to have as few rules as possible, but enough to get uncertainty out of the classroom. You know, I've never quite appreciated rules where the students couldn't understand their grades toward the end of the semester because they were set up in such a way there was so much flexibility of a faculty member that they couldn't, you know. So I've never done that. But I did, at first, of course, you start with undergraduates, and then I taught master's, MBA students. And then I taught PhD students. I mean, that's a normal progression, you know. For a while, I was the director of the PhD program. I had a number of positions that you sort of cycle through or being asked to cycle through. Mm-hmm. At some point, I was asked if I wanted to be considered as an associate dean when changes were going on. I said, I'm never going to be an administrator. I've got to do this. But, no, it was very nice. I did have a good time in terms of being with the students. But, you know, one thing is interesting. When your own culture that you grew up with, you can't really put aside, and I'm not sure you should put it aside. And what that meant was that in Germany, you do not talk to people, particularly like professors or teachers or older people. Don't call them by their first names. And in the university setting, many times the students don't know. And they're not sure, you know, what is the right thing, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes at the beginning, you know, they'll say, what should we call you? And I would say, you know, I'm sorry, but I come from Germany and you don't call me by my first name. And I said, if you want to, I'll call you by your last name as well. Mm-hmm. Well, very few faculty calling the students by their last names. So, you know, I usually call them by their first names. And then they called me Professor My Dalton, Ms. My Dalton, whatever, you know, but not the first name. I said, you can call me by my first name when you've graduated. And you know what is really interesting? Almost nobody does it. I mean, particularly my PhD students. Very few PhD students will ever call me Renata. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, I don't know, it is something that I don't know, maybe my background is such, and it's fine with me, but I remember how hard it was for me to call Professor Fiedler Fred. You know, he was saying the same thing.
Right.
And as graduate student, you know, many times you call a professor by the first name. But it took me forever to be able to do that.
I don't think, even at my age, if any of my professors were still around, that I would be comfortable calling them by their first name.
I guess,
now.
Yeah. Well, that's the way I used to talk to feel. But by the way, the woman who was on my PhD committee, I had forgotten her name. Not forgotten, I couldn't recall. Her name was Peg Fenn, F-E-N-N. in Seattle. She is another, you know, role model that you can do it. Mm-hmm. And the influence you have sometimes when you have no idea that you have an influence, you know, is interesting. Right. I mean, it tells you that every day, whatever you do, do the best you can.
Don't
because
watching.
It might make a difference. I remember, I mean, it's fascinating to me. It's fun. Mm-hmm. I remember in, when was it, 88, I bought a Jaguar. I'd always wanted a Jaguar, you know. I mean, it was just sort of a fun thing. And one of the PhD students came to me and she said, "Professor, my daughter, I'm so glad you have this car." I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, now I know I can do it too." Isn't it wonderful?
It is.
I mean, talk about a car. I mean, what?
Right. I remember that car.
Do you? But yeah. I still have it. It's still running.
Oh, wonderful.
It's perfect.
Wonderful.
And then once I remember I was at the standing in line for tickets. You know, at Hillcrest used to be the movie theater, mm-hmm. AMC theater or something. And I just, you know, you talk to people in line if you stand for a long time. Years later, someone comes to me who don't even remember. She said, "You know, you are the reason I have a PhD." I said, "What?" She said, "Well, you don't you remember we were standing in line, and I was so frustrated, and I didn't think I could do it, and you talked to me, and you told me I should." I said, "No idea." Is that great?
Yeah. Do you have any former students and such that are particularly memorable?
Oh, I have lots of them. Well, you know, I founded the Multicultural Scholars Program. Some people know it, some people have no idea. Has been around since 1992, and I started it in a business school. And actually, the way I started it, Pat, dealt with women's basketball.
Well,
Do you remember?
I was saving that, goody.
Well, let me just give you a little bit. Because of the disadvantaged status of women in sports, and my coming from an area where sports was always open to me. I mean, it never even occurred to me. As a matter of fact, I was doing more sports than my brother Peter, with whom I grew up. But when I got here, I loved to go to sports events. I mean, I love track and field because I used to run myself. And I loved basketball because I used to play field handball, which is different, but same size ball, you know. And it became clear within the first semester that there was something going on that wasn't quite right, you know. Like, I still remember Lynette was graduating, and she was in the middle of the...
Lynette Woodard.
Lynette Woodard, yeah. And she was getting a dozen roses. And before that, I'd gone to the men's senior... The graduating, they got these big and what do you say, engraved or pictures of themselves, and they got the senior rings and all these things. And I said, "Oh my goodness, what the heck is going on here?" Well, I knew what was going on there, but so I contacted some of the coaches. One of them was Coach Washington, who asked me very soon thereafter if I could work with some of her students academically. Mm-hmm. So I designed a system whereby I would, you know, follow them. They would meet with me. We did certain things that put them on track. And by the way, it was always important to me that they had what I call meaningful majors. In other words, anybody who could and was or could prepare or could catch up, depending on which high schools they came from, we would make sure we put them into the most challenging classes that they could be successful in. As a result, we have good number of students, for instance, who graduated in business, who have great careers. I was just talking to, Facebooking, Marthia McLeod, who graduated in business, and Tanya Bonham, who is doing great. I mean, lots of them. But anyway, so on one of my annual reports, you know, to the school, I wrote what I'd been doing, you know, and some of it was service. And so I wrote down women's basketball, whose GPA had improved by one whole point within 1 year. One time, by the way, we had 4 students in calculus.
Oh my.
Lots of students can do it. It's mm-hmm. just they're not being put in there because people who put them in there or not think it's risk-taking, so they make them leave them eligible rather than giving them an education. But anyway, so the dean says, this was Joe Bowman, I think, he said, you know, this looks really good. Can you do something like that in the school? This was in 91, I think. And I said, okay, I'll try. So I started the Multicultural Business Scholars. And by, let me see, by 2000, we had had a lot of administrative changes, and Dave Schulenberger had become provost. And I think he must have told Chancellor Hemingway. And I had a good relationship with both of them. Of course, Dave had been a friend of mine in the school. And I don't know how I knew the chancellor fairly well, maybe from basketball, because he would go to all the games and so on. But anyway, so one day the chancellor said, Renata, why don't you show us what you can do with this and do it, you know, in on campus? And Dave said, I have a donor who will help you get started because it's a mentoring scholarship program. And we had money and an interest to start it in education and in journalism. And so I think by 2000, we had three programs.
Oh.
And by now, we have 11.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's absolutely terrific. And you're asking, you know, do I have students who are good? We have students. Right now, I have one who graduated in business. He's now in med school. He decided he wanted to change his profession. And we had one early on. Well, many, many. I would say almost half go to graduate school. Now, we're talking about students that many times people believe they can't be achieving. They have lower ACT scores than the average. They have higher GPAs in our program across all the years, starting from 92. The average of students in my group, you know, over all the groups by now, GPA is higher than the average for undergraduates at KU.
Oh, how wonderful.
Our graduation rate is way higher. Our graduating on time is higher. And then, as I say, they go to graduate schools. Very large number go to study abroad, all over the world. Graduate schools, Northwestern, Michigan, Harvard, I mean, all top schools. And, of course, once they come out, they have excellent careers. One woman started with Hallmark, went to Johnson & Johnson, went to Ford, the only one hired that year at Ford in marketing. She was the one who was the launching manager for the Ford Fusion.
Oh.
And she was on a picture in the Today Show, on one of the car, not Today Show, USA Today paper. Mm-hmm. And another one who had gone to Harvard, started with Ernst & Young. Ernst & Young is a famous or very large accounting firm across the world. And we had, we needed donations for all these scholarships. None of these scholarships were school founded. So one thing I had to do all the time was raise money. But we had good support. We had good support from later on from Kroger's, Dave Dillon. We had good support from Ernst & Young, starting with Bill Taylor and others. But anyway, actually with Ernst & Young, it started with one of these students who had gone to graduated first generation Mexican American. Started Ernst & Young, went to Harvard, and is now with Harrah's Entertainment in Las Vegas, one of the top positions. But I mean, I have lots of people, of students who have high positions in many different corporations. And now that we have the graduates in all these other programs, you know, we have like people who are in journalism, and I see on Facebook what they are doing and how they are moving up or moving around. Or it is so fascinating to notice, you know, how successful they are. I think we have over 400 graduates now from these programs. Yeah, and then actually I had meant to retire several years before I actually did. But what happened is with the fundraising approaches, another, by the way, donor couple were Doug and Audrey Miller, who lived in the United Kingdom, but our Americans are now here again. And they helped with fundraising. And anyway, at one time he said, well, you know, I pay you some money if you can hire somebody who helps you with the fundraising. So one of my former MBA students came to me and she said, oh, Professor Madalton, I'd really like to help you and so on. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, then why don't we apply for a grant, a government grant called a FIPSI grant. And she said, no, you know, that's hard to do, and KU has never, ever had one, and all of these things. And I said, oh, it doesn't matter. We have all the materials together from fundraising, from others, you know, all the statistics, the pictures, the demonstrations. Why don't we try it? We sent it in, and here it is. I've been awarded the FIPSI grant, which, you know, meant I really stayed on 4 more years, because that's how long the grant was. But it gave us a lot of funding for things we wanted to do. You know, one of these things, part of the program, is taking students to cultural events and taking them to other environments. And so the FIPSI grant, for instance, paid, I think every year we had at least $6,000 in tickets to the Lead Center. And we would go to museums, we would take a bus and go to corporations. In that case, usually, like Hallmark, for instance, would pay for the bus. But, you know, students who had never had the money or the interest to go to the theater or go to listen to an opera and so on, were able to go, not were able, they had to go. It was part of our contract if they were or wanted to be multicultural scholars. So they would get scholarship money depending on how much money the program has, or in business school, how much I had raised. I'd work with the deans of all the schools and so on. Then they would have one-on-one meetings with the directors of each of the programs, and there was a protocol what you had to do when you would meet. And then there would be monthly cultural events, usually followed or preceded by a meal, because it's really important for students to eat, you know.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Students and retirees.
Yeah, the retirees, too. I have a feeling I have too much to eat now. But anyway, so these programs have taken off. And as part of the grant, I also said I would test them out in junior colleges. So we've had 3 junior colleges in Kansas where we had multicultural scholars programs. One of them was at Ark City, Cowley Community College, which is a great place, really. I mean, I'm impressed by them down there. And they keep it going. Even though the grant is done, they have a multicultural scholars program. They have a group. I met with one of their vice provosts, I think it was a title, who wants to expand it, which is great. In the meantime, the Millers wanted to have an expansion in the United Kingdom. And I wouldn't go there, but I sent them all the handbooks, all the materials. They had been involved for 10 years or more, you know. So they visited and saw University of Warwick, which has, I think, 28,000 people. It's north of London. And this summer, the first time I went there, I happened to visit, and they had asked me to come, and they said, oh, we want to go to Warwick. So here we are having another program in the UK. So this is wonderful.
Well, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess. Well, before we run out of time again, I do want you to talk a little about sports.
Oh,
my God. Just for background, I was the administrative assistant.
Oh, yeah.
to Marion Washington she was the director of women's athletics.
Yes.
And you were the angel for women's athletics. You just really kept our spirits up and kept us in their fighting.
In their fighting, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, as I had said earlier, I got to this because I saw the enormous inequality. And, of course, I knew a little bit about business and how to do things. So I stood for election for the athletic board. Because unless you have a little bit of pull, it's nothing you can do, particularly when you're fighting for the underdogs. And so I have been on the athletic board for 4 terms. I think the official term you may take is 3. But then somebody left early and you can't fill out a term. Mm-hmm. But I started before I was on the board. I think the first or second year when I've been here. I came in 79. I think Lynette graduated in 79. No, in 80. The first thing I did when I saw this with the 12 roses versus mm-hmm. all the other stuff is I decided I'd raise some money and give to the coaches and the coaches of the, at that time, active sports. You know, sports are active in the fall. Yeah, you know better than I do. And so it was track and field, and it was volleyball, Bob Lockwood, and it was Coach Washington. Track and field was an African-American coach who couldn't take it anymore and left after a little while. She was very good, too. Anyway, I raised $600. I gave each one of them $200. And Coach Washington could do something for her graduates, you know, at that time. And then I said, well, you know, surely the people understand who are financing the rings for the seniors, that that is something the women should be getting, too. So I wrote a letter. I think it was a K Club. They didn't even answer me. I said, oh, my goodness. You know, that is so impolite. And so I said, okay, I'll do it ourselves. Raised some money. I went to the silversmith downtown. I couldn't afford the rings, you know, that they normally make. But the silversmith made silver rings with lapis lazuli stones, blue for KU, mm-hmm. and had on the sport in the year. And then I would give the seniors, I think that lasted 2 or 3 years. And I think by then, whoever was up there got embarrassed. And the students, which is so interesting, the women, some of them, not basketball, but some of them had no idea what this took to do this. I remember one came, I think it was from swimming, came into my office and she said, well, I understand you have a ring for me. And I gave her the ring and then she was out the door. She had no idea. But, you know, it's because even the coaches wouldn't talk to their players or their athletes about how bad the situation was. And once I was on the athletic board, you know, we had just had Title IX, I think, had come through in 79. And so first thing I did is we had had this investigation. And I think there were 23 things that were wrong, but we were found in compliance because we said we would be fixing it.
Oh, no.
Yes, and within 3 years or something. Oh. So once I was on the board, first thing I did is I said, okay, I'd like us to evaluate if we have fixed it. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was not very much appreciated on that board, never in my 13 years. And I want you to know that even though, you know, I was always polite, I was never aggressive, but the facts spoke for themselves. At the same time, you talk about an administration that's anchored in its own culture, that feels they don't have to do it. Unless they have to do it, they won't do it. I mean, that's the way it was. They'd say, we don't have enough money, the women are not bringing in any money, so they can't expect any. Mm-hmm. Never mind what the law says. I mean, they didn't say that. Mm-hmm. Every time, I mean, I tell you, when I was in those board meetings, every time I would bring up an issue, and I didn't do it every time, but whenever there was something, you know, people either wouldn't respond to what I said. By the way, that happened in the business school assembly until I said, you know, do you recognize that whatever comment I make, nobody is ever responding? You know, that's they didn't do it intentionally. Mm-hmm. Athletics, they did, because they knew if they were to respond, something had to happen, you know. I still remember Chuck Woodling. I had so much more information. He never would interview me and ask me. He'd always go to the athletic director afterwards or to other members. Mm-hmm. And I said, boy, if you only knew what you're doing, you know. But anyway, he was biased against women in most of his reporting. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was a hard life. And when I'm thinking about it now, I mean, I'm glad I did it. And some of the women's coaches, I think, felt some backing, as you say. They appreciated that there was somebody else maybe looking out for it. Because, I mean, if they were to fight too aggressively, it was their job that was on the line.
Right.
And not to mention it was their athletes that would be suffering.
Right.
But, so
and
that...
Some of them were men.
Yes.
Even though they wanted their team to do it, they still might expect that the women wouldn't be quite...
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. I think the exception was Bob Lockhart.
Lockwood.
Mm-hmm. Bob Lockwood was wonderful. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, he was pretty straight in saying what the situation was. Mm-hmm. And he was a good coach in terms of looking out for his...
He was gymnastics.
Gymnastics.
For the record.
I think at some point, though, he also was volleyball mm-hmm. later on.
Yes,
yeah.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that was a difficult situation. Sometimes, goodness, I mean, when I think about it, I tried to raise money. One of them were phone-a-thons, and we needed the telephones in the athletics department. I had somebody from endowment come who were sympathetic, train people who would be on the phone. I don't know if you ever were there. But I said to people in athletics, I said, if you want to send other people that would also be your fundraisers, feel free to bring them in and let them, learn what to do. So we set that up. Then we had the fundraising. I remember the first time, first night or whatever it was, we raised $824 on the phones, which is not a lot of money. This was fundraising for women's basketball at that time. I think the track coach had left. And Gary Kempf was the swimming coach. Right. I didn't have much of a relationship. I think Gary was afraid to speak up, always. Coach Washington would always fight.
Well, I remember once when she was going out the door, we'd been working like crazy, getting all the materials she had to go. She was going to a meeting with the chancellor. Anyway, and I said, okay, Marion, now go fight. And she said, well, I'd like to, but I think I better just lean real hard.
That's exactly what she had to do. But she did lean.
She did
lean. And lots of them didn't. Mm-hmm. But after this fundraising thing, this is another time when she left for a tournament, just getting out the door. She gets a letter from the athletic director saying that the money that had been raised would be applied to her budget, which has a negative balance. And, of course, it had a negative balance because it was given so low, it didn't even include the annual meeting of the coaches, the NCAA meeting, which, you know, everybody has to go
right,
to.
Right.
I was outraged. Here we had done all this work. This man, you know, just takes it all away and thinks he can get away with it. And not only that, he, you know, essentially gives this to the coach like a hook in the stomach before she has to perform, you know, at a major tournament. So I went to the chancellor. And I said, you know, this isn't right. This shouldn't be happening. And Chancellor, I think, understood that officially this was not Hemingway.
No, this is Archie Dykes.
No, I'm not so sure I would put the name in there, but, you know, the one in between those two. Mm-hmm. But people know what is fair and what you can and cannot do. And he knew, even though the athletic director was his friend. As a matter of fact, he mentored him, that he had become the athletic director. And so he had to, you know, set this right. So I had to get a phone call from the athletic director saying, well, he's just at a basketball game of his son's, and he had this call from the chancellor, and this was a misunderstanding. Well, we both know it wasn't. But anyway, I mean, that's the kind of stuff there was. At some time, there was a rumor going around that Coach Washington was going to be fired. And I went to the chancellor and I said, you know, no, I went to the athletic director and had spoken to the chancellor. I said, this makes no sense. Look at all of these coaches that have been less successful. And, you know, you have to give somebody in a down year a chance. We're not talking about the last 2-3 years. We're talking way before then. And again, you know, because I was on the board, and I think they might have been worried about publicity, that's something I never pulled. I could have, you know.
Right.
I could have gone public, but I knew once I take that step, it would be more hostile than officially hostile, you know, overtly hostile.
You did write some wonderful letters to the editor.
Yeah, I did not.
In support of women's athletics.
Yeah, but always, as you mm-hmm. probably remember, I tried to be fair.
Right.
And
right.
I always let the facts speak, you know.
Right. Right.
I mean, I might be passionate about something, but fairness is more important than a given person or sport or an issue. Has always been. I mean, I'll be defending people who are angry with me if I think it's fair.
Well, I think your support and your open support of women's athletes helped a great deal with publicity and such. You know, we were doing many times doing well, but we got no respect.
You're right.
No notice. It could be, you know.
Well, you remember, I almost forgot. You remember I founded the KU Courtsiders?
Yes.
Yeah, the first, I never wanted to call it Booster Club because I hated the word booster.
Right.
But I called it the support group. And that was really wonderful because I think all of you were part of it. We're enthusiastic. We did things that were sort of kind. Coach Washington was so nice to her fans. And she would, you know, bend over backwards to do things that would make the fans happy. So once we started the buses, remember we would take buses to Nebraska, to Columbia, to, I mean, it was fascinating. People were having a good time. Every time on the way back, Coach Washington would have her bus with the kids stop at an intermediate stop in our bus. We would be on the phone and we would talk, and she'd give us the tape. She'd give us the tape of the game, if we could have, so we could be watching it.
Oh.
And then we would all get together with the two buses, you know, and have a little break or something, and then we would be moving on. And you know what happened since Coach left, right?
No.
Oh, my God. No sooner did the new coach come in. I wasn't told anything. I heard that a booster club called the, Hardwood Club had been founded. They took all of our records, all the money balance, never let me know about it. And, as a matter of fact, were not very friendly when I would go to the last graduation banquet when Coach had left and the students I'd worked with were there. I said to myself, boy, how disrespectful and arrogant can you be? So it was, you know, there's still some Courtsiders that are coming to the games, sitting on the other side and never touch the other club. And it's a money game now, you know? Like if you contribute a lot and you forget it. Anyway, what is really missing now is the heart. You know, Coach Washington meant it. She would hug her fans. She would do things.
Right.
And, you know, she meant it. It's all gone. But I'm so glad. I mean, I still, you know, I'm in touch with Lynn Pride. Lynn is a coach now, a high school coach, is having a counselor position in a other school. And, well, many others, you know, and they're doing well. I still remember Tamika Dixon when she was a freshman.
Right.
And I was working with her first semester. She was in, I don't know, HDFL 116 or one class like this. And it was finals time. I had seen the grade and I knew there was an opportunity to retake the final if you wanted to. So I called her and she was not happy at all. I called her in the dorm. I said, Tamika, you can get an A if you retake this test. And I tell you, that A had made such a difference.
Oh, yeah.
And she was brave enough. She took Spanish. You know, lots of students would not take a second foreign language and would take or a foreign language. But Tamika did, and so on. But anyway, it was fascinating. It was fun.
Well, it was certainly a very interesting period in my life.
I can imagine.
Associated with that.
Yeah. What happened? When did you quit? Where did you go from there?
Well, you see, when we were absorbed into the Athletic Corporation.
That's right. She was the director of all sports, and then she had to decide what sport, if she wanted to be director or coach. And she decided to be the coach, right?
They really didn't want it. They wanted to put us in the Athletic Corporation because it was too obvious what we didn't have when we were a department of the university called Women's Athletics.
Yes, that's right. They combined them.
And so they combined us into that, and I always say we didn't merge, we were submerged into the Athletic Corporation.
Yeah.
And I stayed on doing the scholarship.
I see.
For all the sports.
I see. Yeah.
Anyway, so then I was moved out of Women's Athletics office.
I see.
And in various other offices, ending up in the business office. But that was my job, was scholarship.
And let me tell you.
And accounting to the NCAA and the big.
Yeah. What years were those?
I can't remember when we became part of the corporation, but I retired in 88.
Okay.
And
well,
I've been there
quite a ways.
Years. I was there 14 years.
Must have been in the early 80s, probably.
Yeah, because I think it was only women's athletics when I was there a few more years.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of fun.
It was, yes.
You know, the coaches' rooms, the
yes.
coaches' offices.
You remember how tiny
table,
it all was?
One long table and with chairs that weren't left there permanently. You had to go put up your own folding chair and sit at the, and then that became your office where you could deal with your athletes. And,
I remember she couldn't fit the team into the office part where they could, you know, get
and
together.
No dressing room for the women's basketball team. They would dress in the women's bathroom.
Oh, my goodness.
And then bring their clothes down, and they would put them around the sides of my office, which was just the extension of the room.
Yeah.
Anyway, with this back corner. Anyway, Marion did have a closed-off office, which was the one concession they made when they made her director of the department.
I see.
There would be these little stashes of clothes
all
around. And then after the game, they would get them, and they would run through the snow, if that was what was happening, over to the...
Robinson?
To Robinson to shower.
Oh, my goodness.
And visiting teams were put in that room in the annex to the field house. On the ground floor, it was a media room or something, and then it was used for offices.
I see.
But all windows along one side, and visiting teams were put in there for their dressing room, and they had no shower facilities for them.
Let me say something else, which has been on my mind, which deals with student athletes. You know, I have, as I said, I've had the multicultural scholars programs for many years. I know what students can do. And many student athletes are or have been African American, Hispanic American, and so on, many times coming from schools that are not very well financed, and therefore sometimes their education's not as good. Other times they come from good places. But for some reason, people don't believe they can be excellent. Sometimes they do. I don't want to, you know, say that happens all the time. But what really has bothered me, aside from the racial, ethnic background of certain student athletes, what really has bothered me is that in athletics, it seems to be the first priority is to keep the students eligible. And to do that is to dumb them down in terms of the risk you take in the classes you take them in. I've had every once in a while a student in my multicultural scholars program that also wanted or was either a walk-on or an athlete. And I know, of course, all the stuff from Coach Washington and the student-athletes that were all scholarship student-athletes. But they would be getting in and getting math 002. Never mind, they had pre-calculus in high school. And frequently I would go and I would say, you know, you're going to change this. You can never be in business if you start at 002, because you take 002, 101, 115, 116. I mean, you're a senior by the time you know. But anyway, it is so important to have student athletes get guidance in such a way that they can achieve up to their potential. And not only that, they can reach be above what they think their potential is. And eligibility is important, but it should be secondary. You know, even if a student, and usually it's not really the eligibility that comes into play if you take a bit of a risk and you give them a right guidance. But I don't know if I should put this on paper, but, you know, we've had this. First we had Coach Washington, who would go with any major that the students and I and maybe the family decided was the right major. So as a result, we had majors in journalism and in business, and yes, we had communication studies and African-American studies, many times minors, but they had a good chance for a good life afterwards. Last time I looked, when was it, last year or 2 years ago, proud announcement, you know, the four seniors in women's basketball had all graduated within 4 years. And I know they're smart kids, but majors that aren't marketable. Mm-hmm. All four majors that are not particularly marketable. That's not a gift from the coach. I don't care how much scholarship money you give these kids. You are not giving them a future.
Right. That's true.
It bothers me no end. And every semester, every year, we have a new GPA high, how much better we are doing. I did a study of football players that were African-American, and I must say they gave me the data, which was good. 50% of them had a below 2.0. There's no need for that. Mm-hmm. If they get the right guidance, the right mentoring, the right attention, it shouldn't happen that way. And the problem is, what happens many times, particularly with the minor sports, the kids get tutors, and the tutoring has to be scheduled, should be scheduled, that's right for the student. In other words, they should come from school. If they have to, many times they have to go right to practice.
Right to practice, oh yes.
Then they should eat. Everybody has to eat before they get back to study, rather than not having had a break all day, you know. Then they should be able to look at their notes. And then if they need tutoring, they should go and see tutoring. Instead of coming from classes, going to tutoring, not even having had time to look at their material, mm-hmm. you know. And there's the spacing of the classes. You know, should they have four or five classes in a row or four? And then, you know...
Well, we have to do that so that they're available
for practice. You know the rigmarole. But, I mean, you can work these things out, but it takes some know-how and some understanding and some flexibility. And I think that is missing. I tell you, if I had the directorship of this place and had all the money that goes in there, I would give some training to people that they can consider all of that. Mm-hmm. And that they feel they have ownership of helping the student athletes.
Right.
You know?
Right. No, we just use them, really.
I think many times we do.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, that's the end of this.
No,
so almost.
What do you think about KU, School of Business? Oh,
I love KU.
How's it doing?
No, I really love KU. Because of lots of good experiences I've had. I've had good colleagues in the school, not all of them, but I would say most of them. I have very much enjoyed working with both the provost office when Dave Schulenberger and Richard LaRiviere were there. I have very much enjoyed Chancellor Hemingway. I think he was fair. He was bright and capable. He understood the issues. The issues, of course, because he had written his dissertation on Zora Neale Hurston. In other words, he knew about people of color mm-hmm. issues. But I really do enjoy having been part, or I'm glad I was part of KU and the history. And in a way, you know, it's in my nature to try to do the right thing. And maybe if I'd been someplace else, I would have had issues similar or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Kansas in general is a little bit too conservative for me. But on the other hand, I have friends who are, you know, conservative, and I can see their side sometimes.
Sometimes, me too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I'm glad it's a democracy where we live. Even though sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes when I'm in Germany, you know, I sort of long for the system there because you don't have this big difference between rich and poor, which bothers me in this country enormously.
Which is getting worse.
Yes. I think it's
an hour.
I think it's a tragedy for
yes,
a rich country to have I mean, it's inconceivable for me why it has to be that way.
Oh, it doesn't have to be.
Well, let's hope we get a change.
it seems to work that way.
Yeah. Well, President Obama was progress, I guess.
Yes.
I just hope they'll let him do his work.
I do, too. Well, thank you so much. It has been very interesting. And I have known and enjoyed you for many years, and especially now. And I think KU has a lot to be grateful for all of the...
I'm not so sure. I think we all have given our own. You do too. Even if you've retired a long time, you're still working, you're still contributing. You know, I think it's just in our nature.
Well, I I wouldn't want to do otherwise. Neither would you.
Yeah. Right. By the way, I love our new dean. Neeli Bendapudi was one of my students when I was a director of PhD programs.
Oh, really?
I am so delighted that she and her husband are here.
Oh, that's great.
Good change. Good ending.
That's great. Yeah. Well, wonderful. Well, thanks again, Ramada.
You're welcome, Pat.
Stop. There's stop.